What if the patterns of your life, every joy, heartbreak, and seemingly random moment weren't random at all? In this powerful episode of Born to Know, I'm chatting with visionary polymath Robert Edward Grant, who invites us to reimagine the deeper rhythms that govern our existence, from the patterns of conception and birth to the unspoken forces shaping our daily thoughts and emotions. Are you truly seeing the world around you? Or are you unconsciously blinded by systems designed to disconnect you from your innate intelligence? We explore how art, music, and childhood body awareness can help us reestablish connection with our inner wisdom and purpose. Why does sensitivity in men, for example, often feel threatening rather than inspiring? How can embracing both strength and vulnerability lead to true balance, not just for men, but for humanity as a whole? This episode dives deep into emotional suppression, people pleasing, manifestation myths, and the journey of self-love in action. What invisible narratives are running your life, and are you ready to rewrite them? Tune in and discover how the pain you've carried may just be the path to your purpose. This is more than just a conversation, it's an awakening. Hi, Robert. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, nice to meet you. Nice to see you. Great to be here with you.
Yeah. It's an honor to sit in this virtual space with you. I live and work in patterns because I'm in the world of birth and fertility and postpartum, and I do a lot of birth trauma work. So at the foundation of that birth trauma work is understanding the experience that that woman might have had in utero and in childhood, and how what she learned or the consciousness absorbed in those experiences then play out again in adult life. And so, as I was looking through your work and really just enjoying it, and I said, I want to talk to him about patterns. And that's, so much of your work and what you do. And so I've heard many people throughout my life say, this is random. Life is so random sometimes. And I've never ascribed to that because I, from an early age, never understood the world to be that way. And I love what you say, which is, no, it's not random. We just don't understand the pattern yet.
We call it entropy. We call it randomness, but actually, it's not random at all. It's just the pattern we haven't yet perceived.
What becomes available to us? Like, how can we experience, miracle and divinity, if we're in this state of believing that everything is random, that things are not connected? Like, is that a type of victim consciousness? Like, what inspires us to want to be in the state where we believe things are random and not connected?
I think that's a really interesting question, the way you're approaching it. So let's definitely unpack this because I think there's interesting nuances inside of this that we can really capture something maybe very unique from it. So I believe that we tend to want to believe in our own separation from the rest of the world around us. There is a strange sort of comfort inside of that, because we find in that our identity. We spend the first part of our lives, from the time we're children until we get to probably our middle age timeframe, really deciding what we are not. And that's how we define our personalities. It's whatever brings me shame or guilt or displeasure is going to be that which I am not. So we spend the first half of our lives saying, I am not this, I am not that. And then we judge those things that we believe we are not in all the other people around us. And this is a type of deflection. So we find comfort in this because in defining what we are not, we can find, we believe, who we are, our own individuality, our own separation. But as we get in the back half, the latter arc of our life, the feminine arc of our lives, we start to notice that actually, the pattern is really showing us all the things that we had formerly disintegrated from our personas are now coming back into our world. And we are needing to integrate those things back into ourselves. And so the latter half of our lives becomes a focus of, I am that I am, which is paradoxically the name of God. Right? The name of God is the I am that. So you're not separate from anything. And so this is when you start to realize the patterns. In order for us to believe, I am not that, we have to close ourselves off to seeing the patterns that exist. And it becomes beyond our perception. Just like all the aspects of ourselves that we're not aware of, we can't see in ourselves. This is what happens because, you know, an eye cannot see itself without the aid of a mirror. Likewise, consciousness cannot experience itself or cannot perceive itself without dividing itself into mirrors. And we are those divisions of those mirrors. So all our relationships, all the people we meet, all the circumstances we encounter, all of the experiences that we hold and have in our lifetimes are there to direct us in the first half of our life to create this separation, because that's the journey that we're on, in the outer world. And we forget that the outer world is really just a projection of our inner world. So the outer world becomes so complex that we can't see the patterns. And I used to believe in coincidence. And whenever we do perceive a pattern, we say, oh, that's just a coincidence. Well, mathematically, it cannot be so. Because you start to model it out mathematically, and now we have the benefit of ChatGPT. You could actually ask ChatGPT to tell you the mathematical probability of the circumstance that you believe to be a coincidence. And you're going to find that most times, those mathematical probabilities are so beyond anything that you could ever imagine. When I started doing it recently, I started asking ChatGPT this question, and I found that actually, when I mathematically did the probability on it with ChatGPT, it came out that the probability that this was a random occurrence was 10 to the 38th power. Okay, so that's the number one with 38 zeros behind it. So a one chance out of a number with 38 zeros behind it, that is a statistical improbability, that it's an impossibility. That's when you start realizing that what we thought was coincidence is really just a pattern we haven't yet perceived because we didn't zoom out far enough to be able to perceive it. And you're right, that limits our ability to be able to see the miracles that are happening around us every day and the magic that's happening all around us every day, and that you are the creator of your entire experience.
I mean, what systems are in place that keep us in the belief system that there are no patterns? I mean, I can think of a few because there's so much, like you said, so much of childhood is I am not that. And that, you know, that's supported by a parent saying, do not be this way or I will disconnect from you. Do not be this way or I might love you less, right? There's that. There's also school. Either, you know, it's school is really a way to divide the winners and the losers. I mean, I believe that that's what the unconscious mind starts to understand is I have to be this way or I am this kind of thing, right? It's this duality that says, you know, it keeps us incredibly separate. And then I end up reflecting on it, you know, with my own daughter, and it's like, we've taught her, she's separate from everything else. And then she's going to spend the rest of her life trying to figure out how everything's connected, and she's actually not separate.
Yeah.
So I wonder, what are the systems that you perceive to be in place that, you know, it's like, bring us those two steps back. It's like one step forward, two steps back. Like, what is continuing to hold us in this non-belief of patterns?
I think that, you know, the whole education system teaches us not to look at pattern. Because, and not only does it not teach us to look at pattern, it teaches us to not look at connectivity between disciplines that we're studying. You know, we believe that science is very different than art, and art is very different than, you know, the fine arts that might include music, or we don't see the connection between mathematics and music, for example. But anybody who is good at music theory would tell you that all of music theory is based on mathematics. There's not a single aspect of it that's not. And so people that just want to experience the mathematics in the form of music and just feel their way through it are just choosing to experience mathematics in a different way, using their ears rather than their eyes. And geometry could be said to be the music that we experience with our eyes. Architecture is the music we experience with our eyes. But we also get a feeling from it. There's a resonance. It may not be audible to the ear, but it's felt. And this is where we start to have to realize that all of the subjects that we studied in school were actually not separate at all. You know, applied mathematics is geometry. Applied geometry is physics. Applied physics is chemistry. Applied chemistry is biology. Applied biology is psychology. Applied psychology is sociology. Applied sociology is philosophy. And applied philosophy is back to mathematics. It's all connected. It's all a circle. So all the things that we think are entirely separate and different, actually, the anatomy of our brain actually shows us already that they're not separate and different. You know, the left temporal lobe of my brain, which is right here, is where I process mathematics. But where I process music is right here. So it's literally just a mirror effect. One is through the right brain, which is where I'm experiencing music. And the center of my brain is where I experience geometry. So geometry is as to mathematics as geometry is to music, just in a reflective opposite state, like a mirror.
Right, just as mirrors everywhere. Mm-hmm. I became keenly aware of that. I went to Bennington College, so that was my entry point into the intradisciplinary world. You know, I was taking modern dance classes and ballet. It was the first time I was really taking, I grew up playing the harp, but this was the first time I was really now playing with other musicians and having access to move my body, to use my hands, because I was doing sculpture. All of this was being stimulated, and then I could no longer see any of it as separate, because I started, you know, collaborating with one of the piano players, and I was like, I'm going to make this sculpture, and we're going to get someone who does lighting, and they're going to match the lighting to the way that you play the piano, and then I'm going to, you know, so it just became this really magical, beautiful world for me, and I couldn't imagine learning any other way. I said, where was I? You know, what was happening the last, I don't know, however many years, because it always felt so separate, you know, and that, like you said, might be one of the challenges with the education system.
Absolutely, it is. I'm a sculptor myself. And, you know, I noticed that as well, which has been, you know, such an important aspect of this, to be able to see the interconnectivity of all of it. And so freaking beautiful. So beautiful. Just across the board, beautiful. And I'm so grateful that I got to experience this part of my life. You know, I thought that all of this, I was a musician when I was in college. And I gave it up because I didn't think I was going to be good enough as a musician to make money at it. So I need to get serious about life. And so, you know, I went into business instead, and I, you know, went to MBA school and all that. And I gave up music. But now in this latter part of my life, as I reconnect to all these aspects of the things that I said, I am not that. And I had this perception as well that musicians weren't necessarily serious. You know, I had respect for musicians who made professional careers of it, but I looked at it, and I never told anybody that I was a musician, in fact, because I didn't think that that was in line with who I wanted to become. So I had to give it up. Well, in the latter part of my life, I'm now reconnecting to my musical roots. And, you know, I've done a lot of work in music theory as a result, and which is also the nexus of mathematics and geometry. But that's been my reconnection back to music and song and playing instruments and everything. You know, I have every kind of instrument you can imagine here in my because I just love music, and it's a reconnection to the aspect of myself, even the aspect of myself that I would say I am not, that the feminine qualities of myself, right? I sort of disembraced those qualities early in life, and now I've had to start to re-embrace those qualities as I've gotten at this stage in my life. Again, it's all part of the I am that I am stage of life.
What becomes available to you as you integrate those things that are actually a part of who you are, that you said were not a part of you? Like, what has become available to you? Because I know what becomes available to us when we stay divided, right? Which I'd love to ask you about. But what did become available to you? What opened up for you?
Well, what became available to me was probably the most profound aspect, is greater connectivity to my own emotions. So the more things that you cast aside in my desire to be a successful man in the world and align with my masculine, go deeper and deeper into my masculine, responsibility, abundance, you know, manifestation, all these things, I did all those things. But then I got to a stage in my life where I was like, somehow that seems kind of empty, and was very disconnected from my emotional state. So in that, as I started to reintegrate things that were more the feminine qualities of myself and the traits as well, whether it was my connection to music or art or any of the right brain activities like sculpture, right? As I got deeper and deeper into those things, the inner alchemy was allowing me to connect to even deep, dark, hidden emotional states that I didn't even know existed, that I had buried so deeply within my subconscious that they would show up in the world around me. I would be confronted by these issues because you start to realize that all the things that you judge are the things that you attract. Until you no longer judge what you attracted, you'll experience those things in your outer world over and over and over again. So the greater connection to my emotional state has been the most profound aspect of change within myself, I would say.
Wow. And yeah, and it sounds like that's one of the huge secret ingredients to harmony in, let's say, romantic relationship or parenting or children, because I work with so many families, and across the board, one of the main pieces that women express they need more of is this emotional availability from their partner. For example, you know, if we're working together in a consultation, preparing for the birth experience, it's this connection to the emotion that's not there. And, you know, if that connection is not there for the man, how is he able to really hold that space for the woman who is going through this arc? So when you've tapped back into this, that emotional world became more available to you. And then the wounds, let's say, within that, or the hidden experiences, you know, what was beneath the surface there, came up for you to alchemize.
But, and it's funny because I think a lot of women would say that they want men who are more connected to their emotional state. I think they all say that, but I'm not sure that it's actually what they truly desire. I think what they want is they want a man who can connect to their emotional state, and that actually they become very fearful at times if the man is too connected to his own emotional state.
Right.
Because that doesn't give them a lot of confidence that he can necessarily provide and create a secure environment. Because to be in the feminine all the time for them, you know, and with their partner also in the feminine all the time, doesn't necessarily give them the vibe that it's a stable environment all the time. So I think that the desire is to connect to a man who is at least in touch with his own emotions enough that he can be deeply in touch with her emotional state.
It's a level of emotional mastery, right? If he's in touch with them enough, he can articulate and navigate them so that they don't actually offload and impact her, in a sense. They don't offload onto her, but he has the mastery to hold the space, right? So if he has that mastery and she's kind of in her wild, watery world, he can hold that, but that's because of his emotional mastery, not because he's in his super watery world as well. So I agree with you for sure. I mean, it's for me, there's this art of containment that comes in, the dynamic I see, you know, in birth when women really do have to go into a deep surrender to their body and to the process and to, you know, the divine unfolding. So if the man has that mastery, he can hold that space or be the riverbanks, so to speak. But when they are so disconnected from it, they can't even hold that space. They, you know, and I think that's what it is. Like, he's checked out, he's watching Netflix on his phone or whatever it is.
He can't be connected to her emotional state unless he has the ability to connect to his own. And what we're talking about here is how men grow up. I mean, we're taught at a very young age, you know, don't cry, don't do this, don't do that, you know, don't be too emotional. You know, how in the heck, and when the chips are down and everyone's freaking out, right, how are you going to lead and be a responsible leader? And so we often take that as, oh, I'm not supposed to be connected to my emotional state, when it doesn't really mean that at all. In fact, in order to be able to, there is a way for you to be a leader and for you to be in that structured masculine, you know, riverbank stage But in order for you to get there, you have to be at ease and aware of your emotional state. And it's kind of a tall order for society and for women to ask for that of men. It's not built into our society to make men that are like that. And so what's happened is now you have men who are getting more in touch with their emotional state and taking on more and more of the feminine characteristics as a result. I just think it takes longer for men to go through that cycle. And I don't think I really don't believe that the answer is, you know, eighth place trophies. You know what I'm saying? It's like everybody wins type of thing. I don't think that necessarily is the answer also. I don't even know what the answer is on this, but I have to say that at least in my own case, it took me a long time to learn to get in touch with my own emotional state so I could bring myself back to the masculine and also be the container.
I perceive it to be really a deficit in initiations that men, young boys experience today. I mean, cross-culturally and historically, there were initiations of every kind and with all groups of people. And now the way we're set up, it seems to be less and less. And I wouldn't necessarily say like a bar mitzvah is an initiation. It's a marking of passage of time. You know, I just give that example because I had a bar mitzvah, but you know, that initiation really is not there. For many, it's going off to university. And then for some, it's even just becoming a father. That's the first time they feel that they step into some sort of initiation. And it's jarring. It can be incredibly jarring. And so I wonder how we can reintegrate that for young men, young boys, and young girls. But there is such a big focus on we are separate. And as an anthropology major, I know that, you know, we came from a different place of we actually are one and we are together and we work together to create this other stronger unit, you know, to survive in the world, you know, amongst the nature and everything that it has to offer. So it's incredibly individualistic, you know, in a sense. And I don't know that boys are, and girls are given that opportunity to really initiate, and then relationship can be quite hard.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I have a young boy myself who's, you know, be 6 years old in a couple of months. And how I teach him is, you know, I kind of wonder about it myself. You know, in a way, I'm kind of glad that I grew up a little bit out of touch with my emotions in a way, to be honest, because it helped me manifest and live in a tough world. So I got to learn how to manifest and got to learn how to operate in society successfully before I went through my spiritual awakening. And thank goodness for that, because I know so many people that are kind of early on in their watery feminine side and then are unable to really self-actualize at the pace society would expect them to. So for me, the pathway, you know, I can only speak to my own path. I can't speak to how other people should be or what they're experiencing. But for myself, I'm kind of glad that I went through the path the way that I did, and that you know, I realized how to be abundant by, in a way, you know, going through the path where I repressed and suppressed my emotional states early on, and then later on, I woke up to them. But I know at their own different path, and maybe, and I struggle with this. How do I teach my son this? You know, do I teach him, you know, the more traditional masculine path, or do I teach him to be in touch with emotions along the way? Is there a way to shortcut this process so that he doesn't have to have a big crisis in the middle of his life? Well, maybe not, because maybe it's all set.
Yeah, maybe it is all set. I like the idea of controlled adversity, but the way that I provide that really for my daughter is through participating in what I consider to be these ways of, you know, survival, right? It's like learning to cook, learning to knit, learning to be outside, learning to be uncomfortable and resourceful outside, and not intervening when there is conflict, you know, in her world, right? And asking her what she might think is best in this situation. And then also what she might feel in her body, because I've heard you say in various settings that you've had pretty strong psychosomatic responses to situations. And, you know, the recognition of that early on in childhood is so important, because so much of, you know, us being lost in our 20s, 30s, trying to figure out, you know, does this feel good to me? Does that not feel good to me? You know, why am I people pleasing, or whatever it is that feels not right, has to do with early on not being asked, what does it feel like in your body in this moment and what would feel better? So I think the invitation for a child to reflect on what would feel better in that moment, or, you know, in this conflict, what's coming up in the body, that's how they can stay connected and navigate challenging situations. But when we go in to fix and prevent all the time, you know, that's when I think we often create issues for our kids growing up. So either we control and suppress, or we always fix, you know, and it seems like those are kind of two mainstream approaches, or, you know, the average approach, let's say. So how do you think we could actually, support our child in having this change of perception and, you know, stay connected without this control, maybe? Because the helicoptering is a form of control, and the prevention of adversity is a form of control.
I think it's a really good question. And should we practice the prevention of, you know, of some other outside intervention that comes in? And I don't really know the answer to that question. You know, the one thing I've learned through all of this process is the more I learn, the less I feel I actually know.
Yeah, same.
So, I don't know. I think that I believe that everything is predetermined. I believe that what we call free will and destiny are actually synonymous terms, because destiny is the free will of our higher self. And you are that as well. We're just dimensionally limited avatars that are here to have an experience. And so I feel my responsibility with my son and my daughters is to help them along their personal journey that they have chosen, and provide them with perspective, but let them, you know, sort of teaching them correct principles, but letting them govern themselves largely on what they want to experience, and not trying to overly control what it is that they're going to experience and do. But there are certain aspects that I want to make sure I teach my son, you know, how to provide, how to be strong, how to be a man in today's society, and what's expected, so that at least he understands those things and realizes, though, importantly, that no matter what, I love him regardless.
Yeah, that unconditional love. That, you know, however you decide to express in this life, I'm still going to stay connected to you, and my connection to you is not conditional based upon what makes me comfortable. I mean, that's a huge thing in the parenting world, believe it or not, maybe not in our smaller echo chamber, but, you know, it's a very common approach that if you behave this way, it reflects poorly on me, and I can't stand to look this way, maybe in front of other people or a certain type, you know, society, whatever it is. There's a lot of this kind of subversive caretaking, let's say, that happens with children.
I mean, I don't think I would probably lean on that direction at all. You know, it's like my son's choices, what choices he makes are his choices to be made, you know. Like if he decides that later he wants to be gay or something, it's like it's irrelevant on how that makes me look to other people. And by the way, the reason why it's most irrelevant is because I don't care how I look to other people.
Of course, exactly. That's the main thing here.
So if I'm teaching him that I should care through my actions, right, my everyday actions, that I should care, and that I do care deeply about what other people think about me, and I'm looking for validation from those people, I should not be surprised when he grows up in a similar way. What I want to be to my son is an example of authentic living, and not caring how I'm perceived by other people, and still doing what I believe to be the right thing for me.
So if someone is on this path of self-discovery where, you know, like you did with sculpture and returning to music, so I know many people who've abandoned those things because it's not in alignment with the life or like the avatar that they have, you know, curated. What can happen besides living in maybe an inauthentic life? What can happen to the body? What can happen to the mind? What can happen to our capacity to manifest when we are harboring and suppressing these hidden, these expressions that actually want to come out?
I think it's, again, it causes us, by continuing to repress those things, it just builds up this emotion that we have within that are unresolved, you know, and they store up in our solar plexus in particular. And we carry that as, whether we carry it as extra weight or it's a metaphorical weight that we then take on in a physical capacity as well. So I think that's one of the big things. And then it makes it difficult to be in relationship. You know, you might start displaying, dismissive avoidant characteristics in how you attach into relationships, or maybe you're anxious avoidant or fearful avoidant. And you're unable to hold a truly secure relationship, because you might normally, when someone falls in love, you know, if you fall in love, you want to be with that other person. Whereas if you're a dismissive avoidant, the very sensation of being in love is so much vulnerability that it causes you to run away from it and to make up reasons why you can't be in it. And this is sad, because it doesn't mean that's not your destiny. It could very well be that that's been your destiny all along, that you needed to learn this experience. But it's also sad if you cannot successfully learn how to attach into relationships, not because of you having a desire not wanting to attach, because you're just a solitary character that would like to remain in his or her solitude, but rather because you're unable to attach. And then your choices become limited because of that. And I'm always trying to teach my children how to make choices that create more choices for them in the long run, and not limit those choices so deeply that they can't find a way to come back to their own sovereignty.
I think this is in the zeitgeist right now, because there are just women and men that I know who I would say have this kind of divided will, if that's what we want to call it, where they consciously say, I want this, you know, committed relationship, or I want this job, or I want this, I have this vision of my life. But the unconscious mind, you know, is so much stronger, as I believe is the co-creator of this experience. So how, you know, if someone's continuing to pursue this, but it's just not happening, and they're new to maybe this world of manifestation and understanding the power that they hold as a co-creator in this experience, how do they begin taking these practical steps to understand that there's an unconscious desire, belief being driven there that is at odds with what they are saying they want?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because most people that are dismissive avoidant types don't even know that they're dismissive avoidant types, right? I mean, that's the problem. They don't know that they're dismissive avoidant. And so the only way that they can find out that they're dismissive avoidant is either they end up in a relationship that they really valued and lost, or they learn that they're dismissive avoidant because they meet someone who's even more dismissively avoidant than they are.
Right.
And then they experience and they get a full serving of dismissive avoidance, but as a recipient rather than as a, you know, as a perpetrator. And I think that's how they become aware of it. When they finally meet someone who's more dismissive avoidant than they are, then they all of a sudden wake up to their own dismissive avoidance. And then that's when the true healing begins, because the way it works in life is we will attract everything we judge until we no longer judge what we attracted. And the way the universe is going to teach us is through opposites. We experience opposites. So if I'm here to learn unconditional love, I'm going to continue to experience betrayal over and over and over again until I finally learn how to accept unconditional love.
To receive it, you mean, like you learn how to receive it?
I have to learn how to accept its opposite. The opposite of unconditional love is betrayal. So until I've learned to accept betrayal, that it exists, doesn't mean I need to condone it. Doesn't need to mean I need to cheerlead for it. It just means that I need to learn to accept that it exists. Because until I've learned that, I haven't yet learned unconditional love.
Gosh, that is so intense. Like, how does one actually accept betrayal when it might threaten their very existence? Like, it might set off every instinct to survive possible within their system because of maybe something that occurred in childhood or whatever it is. How does one, you know, because someone might say, I accept betrayal, I accept it for what it is. Are they now manifesting to receive it, or are they simply starting to come to peace with it? Like, how does one actually do that?
You come to terms with it and no longer judge it negatively.
Yeah.
The way you'll know this is it no longer triggers you.
Mm-hmm.
If you get an emotional response because you see someone else betraying someone else, and your immediate reaction is no longer, damn, man, I can't believe, I hate when people do that. You know, when someone betrays someone else, I really can't stand it because, you know, it's so bad. You know, they leave a man down. That's just so against my ethos. The moment that you no longer feel that triggering point is the moment you've started to integrate and start to understand what true unconditional love is. So when you're no longer triggered is when you no longer need to learn. When the student's ready, the teacher appears, right? And so as we go through life, the patterns that we have of always experiencing betrayal start to teach us that maybe the reason I'm always experiencing betrayal and seeing it in my outer world is because I need to learn to accept it so that I can really learn what I'm supposed to learn, which is unconditional love. So if you're experiencing a pattern of situations, circumstances over and over and over again, ask yourself, what is the opposite of that thing? And that's probably what you're here to learn. But the universe is going to continue to give you that same experience over and over and over again with increasing severity until you finally learn to accept it. Once you finally learn to accept it, then you don't need to experience it over and over and over again anymore. And it starts to go away. This is the concept of you'll attract everything you judge until you no longer judge what you attracted.
Well, because it's this focal point, you know, whether or not, because we hold that judgment, it's actually just a focal point. It's taking up a lot of energetic real estate. So how can it not come to pass in our you know, little matrix that we've created?
Right. If you truly wanted to learn romantic love, then what are you going to experience here in this world? If that's your deep, you know, conscious desire, you will chase after romantic love and never find it. You will experience the opposite of romantic love. Fake relationships, you know, people that are in the relationship with you for the wrong reasons, over and over and over again, until you finally learn to accept the existence of that thing and let go of the notion that you have of romantic love. That's the moment that romantic love will find you. True romantic love. So you could do this with anything in your life, like literally anything.
Okay, what does that formula look like?
Whatever you will continue to seek. That's why I don't like vision boards very much. You know, vision boards, I think, tend to put separation and space between us and the thing that we want to have.
Because it's an energy of longing is created because you see the thing.
Right. And what you resist will continue to persist. So if the thing that you're feeling like you're feeling lack, and so you would like to always have abundance. So then you put like a picture of you with a really nice car or a boat or whatever on your refrigerator door, right? If you can figure out a way to make that photograph trigger within you this feeling of you already have it, you could use that in a winning way, right? Because the best way to manifest something is to feel as if you already have it. Feel the gratitude, feel the love, feel as if it's already been achieved, it's done. But if you're still thinking of it as an outside object, or it could be the dream man or dream woman that you want in your life, if there's still an outside object, you don't realize that it's already there, then it'll continue to just become more and more elusive from you.
When I'm working with a woman on birth fears, very often where we arrive, like the apprehension about the birth is actually not about the marathon of birth itself, but what happens after, which is the mirroring with her child, the actual moment of parenting. And what she says to me, one woman in particular, I remember she said, I actually realize I don't know, like what I had, I really don't want to do with her. And I don't have a concept, you know, like I don't believe that it's possible for me because I have no blueprint for being a connected mother who's non-judgmental and loving and kind and present, right? And so, you know, I often theorize that a lot of the complications that can arise in the birth space or the turn of events are not because of a biological abnormality or, you know, risk, high risk scenario that we might want to peg it on. It starts to stem from a belief system about what I'm going to do when I actually have this baby, and am I capable of this experience and offering something that feels whole and good and authentic to this child? So do you think there's value? Because you've talked about the future is in the past and the past is in the future, you know, so is there value? I'd love to know more about that, but is there value in a woman and a man, of course, before becoming a father to address this blueprint that they might have gotten as children so that they can prepare for parenting? Is this something that you did or reflected on?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think I still am. It's not that I've done with it. You know, that's the thing, is that these things are so deep in your subconscious mind that they're impacting your outer world and you don't even realize it. And it's like peeling back layers of an onion, right? As you peel back more layers, you realize that there's actually more layers still. It's not that there's just no more onion, right? It's just finer, more subtle aspects that you were not aware of. So I fundamentally believe that our life is a series of this, you know, how do I put it? Awakening is a process of slowly but surely realizing that what you thought was the pain of your life can turn into the purpose of your life. So awakening is a series of softenings that allows your pain of suffering and difficulty to transmute into the purpose of your soul's evolution. And that can be a very beautiful thing. And then you start realizing that judgment was the source of my suffering, but actually suffering is a source of my enlightenment. That all the scars and all the difficulties that I faced and everything that I became aware of, as long as I'm aware of it, especially in this mental matrix that we live in, awareness is key to all of the advancement. Becoming aware of something is 9/10 of the challenge, right? Just getting past the denial stage. And this is true with any 12-step program, right? We know that denial is the first thing that everybody suffers from. And in a sense, whenever we push something into subconscious from our conscious mind, related to ourselves, there's a reason and there's an emotional state attached to that that we were just not willing to feel. And this is how you can have circumstances where someone might have been abused as a child and not even remember that they were abused as a child.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Because they've so deeply repressed it because they simply can't face it. So, but every word along this awakening journey, every word that needed to be spoken but was never spoken, and every emotion that needed to be felt but was repressed and not felt, will both need to be spoken and felt in order for us to get to the next stage of true authenticity. And authentic love is the highest frequency vibration we can experience. And we just come to terms with our own darkness, even the aspects of ourselves that we want to hide from everyone else. We have to come with that in order to really learn and experience true authenticity and love.
I was having a conversation with someone recently, a similar subject matter, and she feels that participating in the religion she grew up in keeps her in a frequency of shame. And she's having a difficult time navigating how to, you know, she understands these principles, and she's almost feeling like the structure of the religion is keeping her in that frequency that she wants to be out of. So her choice point feels like it's abandon the religion and break beyond, or find a way to make it work, but then be in conflict with the religion if I stay within its confines, because the dogma wouldn't allow her to explore beyond those confines. So what does one do when they come into this awareness and they're at odds? They can't live an authentic life because the dogma of this and where they belong, you know, even coming, you know, their family they belong to would even maybe abandon them, right? How do they break out of that, or what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, first and foremost, obviously, there's a lot of familial ties, relationships, friendships, and everything that may not be with us for the balance of our lifetimes. You know, as you raise your frequency, I mean, you could say that from the beginning of your life until the end of your life, at the end of your life, hopefully you experience the highest degree of self-love that you can have for yourself. And along your journey, you meet people and have relationships with friends and family members and everything that are reflecting the degree to which you love yourself. So if you don't like the way people are treating you or acting around you, then you really should look at it and say, how am I treating myself and acting with myself? Because those relationships are merely reflecting the way I see myself. So if friendships are treating me badly and conditionally and in the wrong ways that I don't want to be treated, then the way I change that is by changing how I see myself. I start realizing that, wait, maybe I've been judging myself negatively and loving myself conditionally on all of these aspects. And by changing myself, by being the change I'd like to see in the outer world around me, then I can actually change my entire reality. It's all how we see ourselves that get reflected back to us in our outer world. It's not a universe, it's a universe of projected reality around us, because we don't see the world as it is, rather we see it as we are at that moment in time. And as we so evolve and we have this series of softenings and the awakenings that turn pain into purpose, then we can start to realize that our relationships will also reflect the new way which we see ourselves. If you want to call in the love of your life that loves you in the way that you want to be loved, then love yourself in the way that you want to be loved.
What might that look like? Because everyone, I mean, it's everywhere in the internet. It's, you know, within friend groups, this concept of self-love. And at this point, it's like, for me, it's so kind of like greenwashed that I don't even really personally understand anymore. Because just when I think I felt it, there's this other thing. So what does it actually look like? You know, if you're trying to call in the love of your life, let's say, what does that actually look like to engage in self-love?
So start asking yourself, you know, what do you want as the love of your life? And then be that thing. Once you are that to yourself, then you will start to manifest and call that in. You will reflect that in your outer world. And your next relationship will love you ever more unconditionally and in the ways that you wanted to be loved. If you're achieving it with yourself, it will start to manifest in your outer world. And I believe that wholeheartedly.
On a practical level, does that begin with internal dialogue?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it starts with asking yourself the question, what are the negative self-narratives that are limiting me? Right? A lot of people think, oh, we live in a matrix. We're trapped in this world. We can't do what we want in this world. And it must be some distortion or something like that. No, there's no, this is a heaven or a hell. Earth is. Depending on how you decide to perceive it. It's really that simple. And so when you start to recognize that you're literally creating the world around you with all of your thoughts, words, and actions that are consistent to whatever your negative and your positive self-narratives are, you start to realize then that your consciousness can only expand to the volume of the cage of your own belief systems. So imagine you're in a dream. We're both in a dream. And in your dreams, you're dreaming the first person narrative. You're the narrator of your dream. But who are all the other people in your dream? I might show up in your dream. You might be talking to somebody else on a beach. You're seeing all this light on the beach in your dream, but your eyes are closed. Where are the photons coming from? It's a simulation, in effect, and a mind emergent simulation. And all the other people in your dream are still you. Because who's dreaming it? Well, you are, just you're the higher self. Right? And I said that destiny is the free will of the higher self. So the higher self wants you to experience this dream as the narrator, as the first person perspective. And so it creates all these other avatars of other people all around you who are still part of you. The only one who's perceiving the separation is all the people that are the avatars, but actually it's still the same dreamer. This is just an analogy for what we're experiencing here on Earth, in Earth life. Right? So when you start to recognize that, then you start thinking, oh, wow. So what are the negative self-narrative and limiting belief systems that I have that are limiting me from being able to experience my best, highest form of life? An expansion.
And once recognized, it's a matter of exercising the muscle, so to speak, because I feel it's very fatiguing in my practice of it. It can be, because you're going against maybe years and, you know, loyalties to belief systems and so much that it can feel fatiguing. But is it just a matter of first you begin saying it differently? You rewrite them, so to speak, and you continue to say them until you begin to feel that new truth in the body, right? You make the connection to the cells and to all of these layers of our physical being. Is that the next step?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And I guess when things start to shift in your perceived reality, you know it's working.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely right.
Yeah, it's a hot topic within my world, you know, of birth, because it's hard to take responsibility for those narratives sometimes. You know, I know like victimhood can feel really juicy. It feels really juicy and kind of delicious to say like, I'm not responsible for this. It's happening to me, because to take the responsibility requires the accountability and the work. And it's really uncomfortable. You know, we come into contact with guilt and shame, which we otherwise would not want to, you know, but in that space, a lot of alchemy can happen, you know, and that's what I do say to women. We're finding the purpose of this experience through that pain, like you said, and sometimes the meaning of life actually comes through that alchemy. Women end up becoming doulas, for example, or they say, I want to go into midwifery now, and now I see that through the traumatic birth experience, I've now been able to access a deeper purpose as to why I experience this way. So when we go through this process, how would you say someone, if they're looking for that meaning, right? This is like the big question, maybe. How do we identify that meaning? You know, some of us, I have a friend, she's in her mid-40s, and she's now coming into contact with this. And she said, you know, I've felt lost for so long. I'm trying to find that meaning. What am I here to do? How can we identify that? Do you know? I mean, do you know the answer in this process?
Well, I think, first of all, we all have one major meaning, right? Here on Earth, I believe, and that is to learn love. How to love and how to be loved. It's really that simple. And the only way you're going to do that, because of the nature of the universe, is to really learn authentic self-love. So you can really say that's the whole reason we're here, is to learn true, authentic self-love. The rest of it is just sort of window dressing. We're here to learn how to feel. We're here to learn. We think it's a mental matrix, but the paradox is that the reason for the matrix is for us to learn how to feel, and the ultimate feeling of that is true love, to experience true love. So that is our ultimate purpose. And whatever you do in your life, whatever, you know, that is, you choose your vocation, you choose your, you know, sort of branch of study, whatever you do that is going to be most consistent with you being able to realize that authentic self-love is going to be the right path for you. But that also means you have to be able to provide for yourself, right? Because if you're not really in truly authentic self-love, then you're not going to provide for yourself, and you're going to find yourself always in lack. Because ultimately, the truth is, you just feel like you're not good enough.
That's the result of being in scarcity.
Yes.
Wow. Robert, thank you so much. This has been a beautiful little journey.
I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Yeah, likewise.